What if I told you that the stock market, the thing that dominates every financial news network, every evening broadcast, and like every notification on your phone is just a noisy sideshow?
Right, just a flashy distraction.
Yeah, exactly. We treat the Dow and the Nasdaq like they're the ultimate barometers of economic reality. But if you look closely at how the world actually works, equities are really just the flashy paint job on a much larger, much more powerful machine.
A massive machine.
Sitting quietly in the shadows is the actual puppet master of the global economy, the system that dictates the price of your house, the safety of your bank account, and, the fundamental value of the dollar in your pocket. We are talking about the U.S. bond market.
It really is the engine underneath it all.
It is. So today, using a brilliantly detailed research report as our source material, our mission is to decode this absolute beast of a system for you. We are going to reveal why the bond market isn't just a place for debt, but the literal operating system for American public finance and the benchmark for all global discount rates.
Which is a huge claim, but it's entirely true.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the sheer scale of the bond market dwarfs the stock market, and systemically, it dictates the cost of money for everyone on the planet.
Yeah, and when you look at equities, you are simply looking at a story about ownership value, right? And future growth expectations. But bonds operate on an entirely different level of consequence.
How so?
Well, bond prices actually govern the solvency of borrowers. They govern the collateral that underpins the entire global banking system. A bond market takes the highly abstract language of macroeconomics, like inflation psychology, fiscal credibility, geopolitical risk, and it forces all of those sweeping ideas into a daily, mathematically ruthless price.
So it's basically a translation machine for macroeconomics.
Precisely. It turns theories into hard numbers.
And to understand how that machine controls the global economy, the text makes it clear we have to look at its architecture first. We can't talk about bonds as just one monolithic entity.
No, definitely not.
It's a highly structured system that has been evolving for centuries. The reading actually traces this all the way back to Alexander Hamilton.
Right, very beginning of the country.
Yeah. He didn't just assume state debts after the founding era to clean up the ledger. He did it specifically to create a unified national financial asset that could be traded and leveraged. That was the genesis.
And it just kept evolving from there.
Exactly. The inflation shocks of the 1970s forced the creation of new risk premiums, and then the 2008 financial crisis completely broke the old rules, which, ushered in the era of zero interest rates and massive central bank intervention. What we are left with today is this massive three-layer system.
And the foundation of that system is the government layer. So US Treasuries, which includes bills, notes, and bonds.
The bedrock.
Right, the bedrock. Now, this layer does finance government operations, obviously, but systemically, its actual job is to supply the safe collateral and the benchmark risk-free rate for the entire global dollar system.
Okay, so that's layer one.
Yeah, and sitting directly on top of that is the credit layer. This is your corporate bonds, municipal bonds, and high-yield securities.
Which is where the real economy lives.
Exactly. This layer is the transmission mechanism that passes the cost of capital down to companies trying to build factories and local governments trying to pave roads. And then you have the third layer, which is the securitized layer.
The alphabet soup layer, right? I mean, we're talking MBS, ABS for auto loans and credit cards and CLOs,
Right, collateralized loan obligations.
which is basically Wall Street packaging up loans made to highly indebted companies into a single tradable asset. The text breakdown really made me rethink how these layers interact. Think of this like a three-story building.
Okay, I like this analogy.
So the treasuries are the concrete foundation, the bedrock everything rests on. The credit layer is the scaffolding and the structure of the building. And the securitized layer is all the complex plumbing and electrical weaving through the rooms.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. And, looking closer at that middle structure, the credit layer, the text draws a hard line between investment grade and high yield bonds.
Right, they aren't the same beast at all.
Not at all. Investment grade bonds, which are rated triple B minus or higher, are structurally tied to that concrete foundation. Their pricing is driven primarily by the base treasury rate plus a relatively small credit spread.
So they're mostly just sensitive to interest rates.
Yes, exactly. High yield, on the other hand, sits below that rating threshold and behaves almost entirely differently. It acts much more like leveraged corporate equity risk,
Meaning they're
or
riskier.
much riskier. If you hold high yield debt, you are highly sensitive to recession expectations and default probabilities. If the economy stumbles, the high-yield market prices in that pain immediately, regardless of what base interest rates are doing.
Which makes intuitive sense. But the mechanics of how an investor actually buys or sells any of these bonds is where the text gets really surprising.
Oh, the secondary market.
Yeah, because if you look at stocks, they trade on these highly visible, lit exchanges where millions of people see the exact same price at the exact same millisecond. But most bonds trade over the counter.
Right, OTC.
They trade through this fragmented network of dealers. So if bonds are trading OTC and not on an exchange like stocks, how does an investor even know if the price they see is real?
What's fascinating here is that often it isn't real. The last observed price for a bond on a screen is frequently not an executable price.
Wait, really? So the price is just a suggestion?
Pretty much. I mean, if you own a specific municipal bond, it might not have traded a single time in 3 weeks. The price you see is simply a model's best guess based on similar assets.
That sounds incredibly risky.
It is. Yeah. Institutional investors don't trade based on that quoted price. They have to analyze the bid-ask spreads. They have to evaluate dealer balance sheet capacity.
Which means checking if the bank actually has the capital to hold the bond, right?
Exactly. Does the bank have the willingness to hold that bond on their books until they find another buyer? And they also scrape TRACE data, which is the reporting engine for corporate bonds, just to triangulate true value.
So liquidity isn't just an on-off switch.
No, liquidity is a spectrum. On-the-run treasuries, the most recently issued government bonds, are the most liquid instruments on the planet.
You can sell them instantly.
Instantly. But a 10-year-old corporate bond from a mid-sized industrial company, you might have to spend days hunting for a buyer.
Wow. And since you are relying on dealer balance sheets and fragmented liquidity, just to find a buyer, the actual mathematical price of that bond, when you do finally sell, becomes incredibly important.
It's the only thing that matters.
Right. And the text outlines a central rule here. Basically,
right.
The first law of fixed income. A bond price is simply the present value of its promised future cash flows.
Right.
Therefore, when the required yield in the market rises, the price of the existing bond has to fall.
It's pure mathematics. If you own a bond paying a 4% coupon, and suddenly the market demands a 5% yield for that exact same level of risk, no rational investor is going to buy your 4% bond at face value.
Because they could just go buy a new one paying 5%.
Exactly. So you have to discount the price of your bond so that the total return, the cheaper price plus the 4% coupon, equals the new 5% market standard.
And the metric used to measure how violently a bond's price reacts to that change in yield is called duration, right?
Yes, duration is the key measure of sensitivity here.
The text gives a really stark example of this. It says if a bond has a duration of 7, it means that just a 1 percentage point rise in the market yield implies a roughly 7% decline in the bond's price.
Yeah, a 7% hit.
That's a massive hit to your principal on an asset class that most people define as quote-unquote safe.
It is. And the longer you lock your money up, the higher your duration and the more sensitive you are to interest rate changes.
Yeah.
But the text introduces a concept that complicates that math even further.
Convexity.
Right, convexity. Positive convexity works in the investor's favor, meaning the price rises more when yields fall than it drops when yields rise.
Which sounds great.
It is great, but negative convexity does the exact opposite, and that is baked right into the DNA of mortgage-backed securities.
Because of the homeowner, right?
Exactly. The homeowner's behavior actively punishes the investor.
Explain that, because it's a crazy dynamic.
Well, think about it. When interest rates drop, the rational move for anyone with a mortgage is to refinance. So if you are the institutional investor holding a pool of 30-year mortgages, just as those bonds become incredibly valuable because market rates are falling, the homeowners pay them off early.
Oh, wow. So you get your principal back, which sounds fine, but now you are holding a pile of cash in a low interest rate environment.
Exactly. And you have to reinvest it at those new, terrible yields. You are heavily penalized for the borrower's optionality.
And I assume it works the other way, too.
It does. When rates rise, nobody refinances. So you suffer from extension risk.
Meaning your money is trapped.
Right. You thought you were getting your money back in a predictable window, but because borrowers stopped prepaying their mortgages, your capital is now trapped for years longer than you anticipated, earning a below-market return.
Which completely shatters the safety myth. I mean, people look at a bond, they see a fixed coupon, and they assume their wealth is perfectly protected. But the text highlights a whole gauntlet of risks.
There are so many hidden risks.
Like inflation risk, where your fixed coupon technically gets paid, but it loses its actual purchasing power in the real economy. And then there's the opportunity cost of being locked into a low rate while the market moves on.
Both very real dangers.
Let me pose a scenario for you on behalf of the listener, because they might be thinking, if I buy a U.S. Treasury and I just plan to hold it until it matures in 10 years, why do I care if the daily price drops by 7% of getting my full money back at the end, guaranteed, right?
It's a fair question, but the danger is the liquidity trap. Assuming you can hold to maturity requires assuming your life, or your institution's balance sheet, remains perfectly stable for a decade.
And life is rarely stable.
Never stable. If a corporation faces a sudden cash crunch, or an individual faces a medical emergency, and they absolutely must sell that bond to raise cash,
they don't have the luxury of waiting for maturity.
Exactly. If they are forced to sell during a period when yields have risen, they are crystallizing that mark-to-market loss. They take a massive haircut on their capital simply because they needed liquidity at the wrong time.
So safety is highly conditional.
It's an illusion if you don't understand the mechanics.
Right, because investors face all these intersecting threats: inflation, opportunity cost, extension risk, liquidity traps. The yield that they demand to hold a bond isn't just a random number. It's a carefully engineered formula.
It's built block by block.
Here's where it gets really interesting. A bond yield is essentially a stack of risk premiums. I was trying to visualize this while reading the report. And the best framework I could come up with is a fast food order. The yield is basically the total price of a customized burger.
Okay, let's follow the logic of the burger stack.
All right, so the treasury rate, that base risk-free rate, is the burger patty. It's the absolute minimum requirement for the transaction to take place.
Makes sense.
Now, if you want to take on the risk of inflation eating away your returns over time, you have to add the cheese. That's the inflation premium.
Right.
If you are lending to a corporation and taking on the risk that they might default, you have to add the bacon. That's the credit spread.
The default risk.
Exactly. And if the bond you are buying is obscure and trades infrequently on those OTC networks we talked about, you have to pay for the special sauce, the liquidity premium. By the time you look at the total yield quoted on your screen, you are just looking at the final price of the patty, plus all of those specific risky ingredients.
That's actually a great analogy. And taking that framework further, understanding how those individual ingredients reprice independently is the entire game in fixed income.
What do you mean by independently?
Well, imagine a sudden, severe global growth scare. The market panics about a recession. Capital flees into the safest asset available, driving massive demand for U.S. treasuries.
Because everyone wants the concrete foundation.
Right. As a result, the base treasury yield plummets. The patty gets significantly cheaper. But simultaneously, investors are terrified that corporations are going to go bankrupt.
So the credit spread blows out.
Exactly. The compensation demanded for default risk skyrockets. The bacon gets wildly expensive.
So a corporate bond's overall yield might actually go up, and its price might crash, even though base interest rates are falling.
Yes. Simply because the panic priced into the credit spread overshadowed the drop in the treasury rate. Professionals don't just look at the total yield, they isolate which premium is moving.
That is wild.
It is, and this is also why the broader yield curve is the ultimate macro dashboard.
Let's talk about the curve.
The curve plots the yields of government bonds across different maturities. The front end of the curve bonds maturing in a few months to a couple of years shows us exactly what the market expects the Federal Reserve to do with short-term policy rates.
Okay, so that's the immediate future.
Right. Then the belly of the curve, the 5 to 7 year range, reflects expectations for medium-term economic growth and inflation.
And the long end.
The long end, the 20 or 30 year bonds, shows us the term premium. The term premium is the extra compensation investors demand simply for locking their money up for 30 years instead of 30 days, alongside their judgment of the central bank's long-term credibility.
And the text points out that the shape of this curve is a massive signal. Normally, it slopes upward, right? Because locking your money up for 30 years should pay more than locking it up for 30 days.
That's the normal, healthy state.
But when the curve inverts, when short-term rates are pushed higher than long-term rates, it's a massive red flag.
A huge warning sign.
It means money is tight right now, but the market is betting the economy is going to choke, forcing the central bank to panic cut rates in the future. Which brings us to the puppet master. If the yield curve is the ultimate dashboard dictating the cost of money, who controls the dashboard?
The Federal Reserve.
Right.
The Fed controls this market through several very specific levers. The most immediate is the policy rate, the Fed funds target, which anchors the cost of overnight money for banks.
So they set the floor.
Yes. Then they utilize forward guidance using speeches, press conferences, and projections to manipulate market expectations months before they ever actually execute a rate change.
Just talking the market into doing what they want.
Essentially, yes. But the most profound, heavy-handed tools they have deployed in the modern era are quantitative easing and quantitative tightening.
Ah, QE and QT. I want to dig into the mechanics of quantitative easing here, because the public discourse around this is usually just memes about the Fed, quote-unquote, printing money.
Right, the money printer meme.
But looking at the mechanisms detailed in the source material, it's not a simple money printer. The Fed isn't just mailing checks to people. They are going into the market and buying massive amounts of long-term treasuries and mortgage-backed securities.
Massive amounts.
And by doing that, they are executing a massive duration extraction. Is it really just about manipulating the supply of safe assets so investors are forced to go take risks elsewhere?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, yes, absolutely. Duration extraction is the exact right way to phrase it. The Fed creates bank reserves to purchase those bonds. They are swapping a yielding long-duration asset, the bond, for a zero-duration asset, the reserves.
They are actively removing safe yield from the private sector.
Precisely. Think about a massive pension fund that requires a 7% annual return to meet its obligations. If the Federal Reserve has bought up all the safe government bonds, compressing their yields down to 1% or 2%, what does that pension fund do?
They can't just sit in cash.
No, they are mathematically forced to move down the risk curve. They have to buy corporate bonds or equities or commercial real estate just to hit their targets. QE is a mechanism designed to artificially compress long-term yields and intentionally force the private sector to take risk.
So it's engineering risk appetite by starving the market of safety.
Exactly.
In quantitative tightening, QT is the exact same mechanism running in reverse, right?
Yep.
The Fed stops buying. They let those bonds mature and roll off their balance sheet.
And suddenly, the private market has to absorb all of that duration risk again.
The supply of collateral floods back into the system, reserve balances are drained, and it acts as a gravitational pull on liquidity everywhere. It pressures everything from overnight repo markets to the ease of trading a basic treasury.
Mm-hmm. QT forces the private sector to finance the government's debt out of its own pockets again, without the central bank acting as the buyer of last resort. It raises the baseline cost of capital across the board.
Okay, so we've mapped the architecture. We've gone through duration, convexity, the yield stack, and the Fed's duration extraction. Let's bring this entirely out of the theoretical and into the practical.
Let's do it.
The text uses a beautiful phrase. The bond market sets the quote-unquote price of time. How does a shift in that price of time, a shift in treasury yields, actually impact the assets that you, the listener, care about? If I'm an investor heavily weighted in the S&P 500, especially big tech, how does the bond market dictate my portfolio's value?
It comes down to discounted cash flow models.
Okay, explain that.
Every financial asset is just a claim on future cash flows. To figure out what a dollar earned 10 years from now is worth today, you have to discount it by a specific rate, and that rate is set by the bond market.
So higher rates mean future dollars are worth less today.
Exactly. Tech companies and growth stocks in general are highly dependent on massive profits projected many years into the future. If the risk-free rate from the bond market goes up, the denominator in that math equation gets much larger.
So the present value of those distant profits plummets.
Right. The company's underlying business might be perfectly fine, but the stock price has to re-rate downward simply because the price of time became more expensive.
Okay, so that's the impact on Wall Street valuation models. But if the price of time is getting more expensive, it has to be brutal for something tangible like housing, where everyday people and businesses are borrowing massive sums.
Oh, real estate is entirely captive to the bond market.
The text specifically links the treasury market to real estate.
Yeah, mortgage rates are priced at a spread above the 10-year treasury yield. When the 10-year spikes, mortgage rates spike instantly. Housing affordability collapses, freezing the residential market.
And what about commercial real estate?
In commercial real estate, it's governed by cap rates, commercial capitalization rates. This is the baseline return an investor demands to buy an office building or an apartment complex.
It's competing directly with bonds.
Exactly. If you can get a guaranteed 5% return from a risk-free treasury, you are going to demand a 7 or 8% cap rate to take on the risk of owning an office building.
And to get that higher yield, the purchase price of the building has to drop significantly.
The bond market dictates property values, full stop.
And it doesn't stop at the U.S. border either. The text shows how U.S. yields dictate global capital flows. If the Fed pushes yields up, capital from all over the world floods into the United States to capture those returns.
Which strengthens the U.S. dollar.
Right, which is great for Americans traveling abroad, but it acts as a wrecking ball for emerging markets that have debt priced in dollars. It also crushes the price of commodities like gold, which don't pay a yield and struggle to compete with a high-yielding, risk-free dollar.
It touches everything.
And finally, the structural link to the banking system. The text explicitly points out that rapid rate shocks create massive unrealized losses in bank securities portfolios.
This is the core linkage between bonds and banking stress. Banks take in short-term deposits and buy long-term bonds.
But if rates rise rapidly,
the duration math we discussed earlier kicks in. The market value of the bond sitting on the bank's balance sheet plummets. If depositors suddenly demand their money back, the bank has to sell those bonds at a massive loss to generate liquidity,
destroying their capital buffer in the process.
Exactly. The bond market's pricing is what turns a theoretical macro shift into an acute banking panic.
It's the invisible gravity pulling on every single dollar. So, what does this all mean? To bring our journey full circle based on the source material, the U.S. bond market is a massive three-layer system: government, credit, and securitized.
It operates on strict mathematical laws where yield and price move inversely.
Right. Every yield you see is a carefully stacked cake of risk premiums. And the Federal Reserve manipulates the supply of those assets to force the entire economy to either take risks or retreat to safety.
It is the ultimate foundation of global finance.
Yeah. It's not some niche arena for institutional math nerds. It dictates the value of the dollars in your bank, the valuation of the stocks in your retirement account, and the price of the roof over your head.
It does. But, you know, there is a final lingering thought from the text that frames all of this in a slightly terrifying light.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Throughout this deep dive and throughout the entire architecture of global finance, we treat the U.S. Treasury as the ultimate safe asset.
The concrete foundation.
Right. It is the base layer for every risk premium, every mortgage rate, and every stock valuation model. We treat it as risk-free because there is no nominal default risk.
Because the U.S. government can theoretically always print the currency needed to pay its debts. The ultimate bedrock.
But the text issues a clear warning. Treasuries still carry massive inflation risk, immense duration risk if rates spike, and increasingly severe political risk regarding the debt ceiling and fiscal deficits.
Which raises a really fundamental question.
It does. If the entire global financial system, every bank, every pension fund, every corporate valuation, uses the U.S. Treasury market as its flawless, unquestionable foundation, what happens if that foundation experiences a severe crisis of liquidity or confidence?
We started this analysis by comparing the financial system to a three-story building, with treasuries as the deep concrete foundation. The real question is, what happens if the concrete itself starts to crack?
It's a scary thought.
If the baseline for all global risk starts shaking, how can the credit markets, the stock market, or the banking system built on top of it possibly remain standing? It's an essential, sobering question to walk away with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Until next time, keep looking past the daily headlines and start questioning the foundation.